are Locked On NBA, your daily NBA podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
What's up and welcome to another Monday edition of Locked On NBA, the biggest stories with the local experts. I'm your Monday host, Jackson Gatlin, also host of Locked On Rockets right here on the Locked On Podcast Network. Today, we get both sides of the Donovan Mitchell trade. First, we'll be chatting with Evan Damerel from Locked On Cavaliers to figure out, was this a fair price to pay for the Cavaliers to acquire Donovan Mitchell's services? What does he look like paired with Darius Garland in the backcourt for Cleveland? And how does this maybe push forward the timeline for the Cleveland Cavaliers to be competitive? Then we chat with David Locke from Locked On Jazz to find out why now to move on from head coach Quinn Snyder, Donovan Mitchell, Rudy Gobert. How confident are the Jazz in Danny Ainge's plan to rebuild this franchise moving forward? We're going to get there in just a moment. But as always, thank you so much for making Locked On NBA your first listen each and every day. We are free and available on all podcast platforms. That's Apple, Spotify, Google, the Odyssey app. We're also on YouTube. So go to YouTube, search Locked On NBA. Be sure to like, comment, and subscribe. Joining us now is Evan Damerel from Locked On Cavs. You can follow on Twitter at AmNotEvan. Now, Evan, the Cleveland Cavaliers picking up Donovan Mitchell in another. There have been a couple blockbuster moves this summer with, you know, star players on the move, but, you know, trading with the Utah Jazz, sending out Colin Sexton via sign and trade, Lauri Markkanen, Ochai Agbaji, and three firsts, two swaps. Quite a haul for Donovan Mitchell. Let's start, before we get into what this means for the Cavaliers organization moving forward, what Donovan Mitchell brings to this Cavaliers team. How do you feel about the overall price for Donovan Mitchell, the outgoing assets that Cleveland had to give up to make this trade happen?
So I've kind of debated this internally for a while. And if you're the Cavs, you have two all-stars in your roster in Darius Garland and Jared Allen. You have a guy who's ascending in Evan Mobley, who you can make a case could be an all-star in the foreseeable future as well. And players of Donovan Mitchell's caliber, who, depending on how everyone else feels, I think he's a top 20 player in this league, arguably one of the best players at his position overall. Like, when they become available, you have to really take a long and hard consideration into saying, okay, in our heart of hearts, is this guy going to maximize our potential in a very strong Eastern Conference? Because let us not forget, there's Boston, Milwaukee, Philadelphia, Miami, Brooklyn, even though they're a bit of a wild card, Atlanta. There's a lot of good teams in the East this year. And if the Cavs kind of want to push themselves into that conversation out of the play-in, you have to really weigh your options here. And yes, people can kind of say, oh, they had something similar to that in Colin Sexton. And I hardcore disagree with that argument. We can get into it if you want later. But I think it was worth the price if in your heart of hearts, it does make your team better and it pushes you further into the conversation out of the play-in tournament and into the playoff talk instead. Because let's be frank, before this trade, the Cavs probably were optimistically a top six team, and now they could be flirting with top four if they really like just maximize their youth and take advantage of some of the older teams in the East as well. But at least now they have a dog in the fight in this conversation, and it's a little surreal to think that now, instead of three all-stars in their starting lineup, they have four, and now small forward is just the biggest mystery for Cleveland, as it was before this Donovan Mitchell trade.
I'm glad you brought up Colin Sexton there, because I think he, and maybe you'll agree, maybe you want to push back on this, but I think he got paid a little bit more than what people were expecting here with this deal as part of the sign and trade on the way over to Utah. But that was one of the components that had to come to fruition, right? Because the Jazz had to agree on that salary, the Cavs had to agree on it, and ultimately Sexton had to be okay with that contract and be okay with being dealt to Utah. So how good was it to actually see that situation come to, you know, a positive resolution, one that really helps the Cavs moving forward? And you mentioned kind of the comparison there between Sexton and what Donovan Mitchell brings to the table. How much of an upgrade is this at that position for Cleveland?
So last time I was on here, we actually talked about Colin Sexton's just contract situation as a whole, and the number floating around in the ether that I've heard, many of others heard, it was about $13.3 million annually, which is pretty much the absolute max the Cavs could sign Colin to without going to the luxury tax threshold, and they were still mindful of that. They were able to avoid the luxury tax when they acquired Donovan Mitchell as well, which is savvy cap management on the Cavs' part. But for me, at least, when I heard Colin, in the grand scheme of things, like, a lot of teams had him pegged at his absolute cap, $18.5 million overall, like, annually, if you just did, like, a flat rate. If you break down this contract from Utah, it's $72 million over 4 years. It's about $18-ish million annually. I think Bobby Marks reported that it's a backloaded deal. So it'll be a little lighter at the beginning, and then it'll be heavier towards the end, which is, you know, all more power to you, Colin. There was a lot of uncertainties around him heading into this offseason. Again, something we talked about, and that's kind of working in Cleveland's favor, at least in these negotiations, was he's coming off a pretty serious torn meniscus. Like, it took him a while to get back on the court. We haven't seen him play in almost a calendar year. He only had 11 games under his belt. We don't know how he looked on a winning team. There's so many different variables and factors at play here. And the issue was, because he was a restricted free agent, not a lot of teams were going to be lining up to begin with to try and maybe fight the Cavs in this RFA battle. And teams with cap space were Indiana and San Antonio by the time this trade happened. And I see neither team really hardcore going after Colin. And Utah was always floated in the ether as a team who was interested in him. I think Jake Fisher was the first to report it, and a lot of people can corroborate it after the fact. But I'm happy for Colin. I'm happy he got paid. I think, again, as we talked about, the knee injury could not have come at a worse time for him, especially because the Cavs went on such like a dramatic run even after he went down, that he kind of bet on himself last offseason, and then unfortunately had the knee injury and lost a lot of guaranteed money, and obviously saw a smaller contract because of it. So him to kind of get closer to 20-ish million, especially because he considers himself a starting guard and his agency considers himself a starting guard, like, that's great. I am always a proponent of players getting paid, especially when this is becoming a multi-billion-dollar league and the salary cap is definitely going to go up in the next few years. So this contract of Colin Sexton's is going to be a small potato as soon as the new TV deal comes out as well. So I'm not too pressed on the overall price tag that he signed, but I'm happy he was able to get more of the money he was comfortable with. And I think end up ultimately in a situation where he can maybe rehabilitate his image as well and show that he is still one of the better guards at his position, especially in terms of scoring, just as an elite three level scorer. But to your point with Donovan Mitchell coming in, I wrote about this a little bit, and I think the best way to put this is Donovan Mitchell is a real-life, self-actualized version of what the Cavs wanted with Colin Sexton, where you could talk about their true scoring numbers, or you could break down the percentages and everything else. Like, yeah, they're pretty comparable, but the way they got their buckets were pretty dramatically different, where Donovan really likes to thrive or beyond the arc. And yes, he has plenty of attacks inside the arc as well, especially at the rim, where like high-flying dunks and everything else. But with Colin, it was mostly in the mid-range. It was mostly at the basket. It was mostly at the free throw line, where, and you can correct my math if I'm wrong here, 3 is greater than 2. And if you're the Cavs and you're a team that is a proponent of playing 2 7-footers at the 4 and the 5, having that extra spacing, especially at the 2-guard spot and on the perimeter, helps so much more and helps you in spades when you're trying to really take this next step. So it's the shooting aspect. I think it's the scoring punch. I think he's going to relieve a lot of the defensive pressure Darius Garland faced last year, because Colin Sexton just is not on the same plane as Donovan Mitchell. Like I said, Mitchell's a top 20 player and Sexton isn't getting paid like a top 20 player. So we can discuss that as he won as well, but there's a lot of semantics can go around with Colin Sexton. His fans are a sensitive bunch, but either way, I am a proponent of this trade. I'm a fan of it. And also it's the playmaking stuff too. I think there's a lot of interesting wrinkles the Cavs can kind of get creative with this. I think also when you just look at how the Caris LeVert trade went down last season and how the Cavs are just kind of positioning themselves, they couldn't really afford to wait and see, okay, is Caris LeVert really going to be the help that Darius Garland needs on the perimeter in terms of just defensive pressure? Can Colin Sexton be that after a serious knee injury? Like the Cavs can't afford to do that, because the future is kind of now for them, because they just make Garland the highest paid player in franchise history. I mean, in terms of his contracts, and you really got to accelerate things a little bit. And I don't think trading for a star necessarily accelerates it to an extent. There's a lot of other pieces that have to work in favor for Cleveland, but it's a good fit for the Cavs overall. Like, I give it 2 thumbs up. I don't think it's going to make them, you know, instant NBA champs. This isn't LeBron finagling to get Kevin Love to join him in Kyrie Irving kind of situation, but it's definitely going to set up Cleveland pretty for at least the 3 to the next 4 years, depending on what Mitchell wants to do with his last year of his contract.
Coming up, we continue on with Evan Damerel from Locked On Cavaliers about what this trade means for Cleveland and how we see Donovan Mitchell fitting in with the Cavaliers. But first, a quick message from our friends over at Built Bar, because when it comes to protein bars, you got to check out Built Bar. They're the number one protein bar on the market, and for some very good reasons. Every single bar is coated in 100% delicious chocolate. They're soft. They're easy to chew. They're not gritty like other protein bars that you'll find out there. Every single bar is low-cal, low-sugar, high-protein, high-fiber, amazing if you're on a keto diet, maybe amazing if you're trying to cut back a little bit, maybe lose a little bit of weight. And they've got so many incredible flavors to choose from. You've got raspberry, strawberry, salted caramel, cookies and cream, mint brownie, peanut butter brownie. My personal favorite is the coconut brownie chunk. You really can't go wrong with a single flavor on their menu, though. You can check them out at built.com. Use promo code LOCK15 to get 15% off your very next order of the best tasting protein bars on the market. Again, that's promo code LOCK15 for 15% off at built.com. And continuing on here at Locked On NBA Monday, where we appreciate you for making Locked On NBA your first listen each and every day. It's also, and for what it's worth, I absolutely love this trade for Cleveland. Like, I think this is exactly what you want to see out of a team that, you know, maybe surprised quite a few people, performed well beyond expectations this past season. Obviously, battled some injuries near the tail end of the year. Losing Ricky Rubio really hurt. The injuries to Allen, you know, slowed things down considerably at times. So, you know, I do think that this is a Cleveland team that kind of surpassed expectations, and now you add a true blue star to that mold in Donovan Mitchell. Again, like you said, adding a fourth all-star to this already exciting young core. And it's not like Donovan Mitchell's, you know, in his prime years right now. He's not 30, 31 with only a few good years left in the tank. Like, you could conceivably have this core for Cleveland together for the next 5+, 6+ years if things work out. Now, the big question, right, is how do Mitchell and Garland complement each other, right? How do they fit together as a backcourt? And one of the interesting thoughts that I had, Evan, and I'm curious to know your thoughts on this, is how do those two guys potentially even pair with kind of this crazy inverse, right? Like, this past season, we saw the Cavaliers running like big ball, right? Like, they had so many, you know, sizable players at times running like three bigs all at one time on the floor with one another. Whereas this next year, it feels like they're downsizing quite a bit more. And I'd be interested to see if they're going to even run some lineups that feature Ricky Rubio out there with Mitchell and Garland at the same time. And then obviously, you know, Mobley and Allen kind of guarding things on the back line there.
I think that's an interesting way to look at it. To quote J.B. Bickerstaff, the proper term for donkey is what he would use. It would be like a big donkey lineup, but we can't swear on this network. We got to keep it PG here. So that's what J.B. Bickerstaff called it last year. It was weird. It was unconventional. I think the Cavs made it work because you have just a freakish defensive tandem of Mobley and Allen just blotting out the sun at the rim, and that kind of covered a lot for what Larry Markkanen lacked in terms of defense, what Darius Garland lacks in defense. I mean, even Donovan Mitchell now, but there's a lot of questions or a lot of variables at play. I think they could still go tall, like Dean Wade, Lamar Stevens, both power forwards in college, are being asked to play the three more often than not for the Cavs now. Wade shared with the media that it's been a little tough at times to make that adjustment from going from being a four collegiately to just being put on the wing, and they're adequate at that position. I think Lamar Stevens does a really good job. I think Isaac Okoro is going to be the biggest X factor in all this, where if he's able to be even semi-average in terms of shooting, like, that's going to just pay off in spades for the Cavs, because defenses just don't keep or are not honest on the perimeter when Okoro is out there. And so just in terms of the pairing of Mitchell and Garland, I love it. To be frank, you saw it last year with Garland, especially when he said when after Sexton went down, but especially after Rubio went down, the Cavs dealt with injuries. They dealt with COVID. I mean, every team does, but like, the Cavs had to ask more of a lot of their players. And I think Garland rose to the task for the majority of the season, but you started to see the fact that he's only in his third year in the league. This is the first time he's played such a full gamut, and every game actually means something. He's having nagging back issues that flare up against like Milwaukee and Golden State. It just kind of became a continuous issue. He was shut down for 2 weeks, I think, after the All-Star break, just to kind of rest and recover. And it was still an issue for the remainder of the season. And that's what you hoped Caris LeVert could do. And now with Mitchell, the pressure isn't so much on Garland and ask him to do more in the event there are injuries again. And as you noted, when Rubio is healthy, like, that helps a little bit too. And I think that gives them some creative options. And I just think offensively, this is a really, really good tandem between the two. I think those two being close off the court and just kind of familiar with each other to begin with is just going to translate nicely chemistry wise. I do think there are going to be some growing pains in terms of just whose turn is it to shoot it? Whose turn is it to handle it? Like, that those are fair things. I think that Darius being used to playing with Colin Sexton a little bit helps, but again, Donovan Mitchell is a different beast than Colin Sexton at this point. So like, you have to kind of change things a little bit. And I think the fact that defensively, it's not going to be seamless to start the season either. I think you're going to be asking a lot more of Evan Mobley and Jared Allen just to kind of cover for those two, because Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland are both 6'1". That's going to be a turnstile on defense. And that's, I think everyone knows that at this point, like, that's one of Mitchell's biggest weaknesses, and why Utah was able to function so well is because of Rudy Gobert. But I'm a fit. I think there's going to be some growing pains just because this is a young team who's trying to prove they belong in the Eastern Conference, and we'll just see where it's going to go. I think it's a good problem to have. I think that's my biggest takeaway, is it's a good problem to have, and now it's on JB Bickerstaff and his coaching staff and the rest of this roster just to try and make these pieces fit and kind of bring in this all-star level player, because you're not bringing in a role player, you're bringing in an all-star, star level player. Like, you have to kind of meet him halfway on some things, then also Donovan Mitchell has to meet the Cavs halfway on certain things in order to make like a healthy, conducive winning environment.
I'll be curious to see if JB can keep kind of that defensive identity intact, even as you alluded to, right? The, you know, some of the concerns maybe with the perimeter defense between the duo of Garland and Donovan Mitchell. But like you mentioned as well, I mean, Gobert was the one who anchored everything for that Utah Jazz team. Very similar backcourt over there in the fact that you had two kind of 6'1 guys in Mitchell and Mike Conley. And so it's not like the Jazz had great perimeter defenders either. And when you have a tandem duo in Jared Allen and Evan Mobley as your back line to kind of, you know, just gobble up anything at the rim, you know, guard the rim, keep a lid on the basket, that kind of thing. Hopefully the defensive identity stays intact for the Cavaliers moving forward. But you touched on Isaac Okoro there momentarily. You know, is he the de facto fifth starter for this Cavs team? Because to me, I think he is, right?
I would say it's an open competition. Chris Fedor, who is probably the most plugged in beat writer, said that at least for now, Caris LeVert's penciled in as the starting three for the Cavs. Maybe that's just trying to boost his trade value, but JB Bickerstaff is kind of a coach where he won't say anyone is a starter heading into training camp, and he wants it to be an open competition. But let's be frank, it's...
Yeah, Donovan Mitchell is going to have to fight for his roster spot going into training camp. It's going to be great.
So, but let's be frank, unless your name is Garland, Mitchell, Evan Mobley, or Jared Allen, I think you feel pretty safe about your chances in the starting five. I think it's going to be an open competition for the starting three. Maybe Lamar Stevens pushes them a little bit. Maybe Dean Wade, if he's healthy, pushes them as well. Like, I think that's a good thing. I think that's a good problem to have for the Cavs, because you're going to have guys pushing each other. But if I had it my way, and I've said this many of times before, there's a reason why I'm on a podcast and hosting Locked On Cavs and not an NBA coaching staff, but Isaac Okoro makes a lot of sense, at least defensively, to cover some of the perimeter issues that Garland and Mitchell kind of present on the defensive side of the ball. But again, if Okoro is not able to become just a below average or even average three-point shooter, it's really tough to have him out there, because good, smart defensive teams like Boston is always my prime example. Like, you watched Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown's taking turns sagging off of Okoro on the perimeter and kind of acting as a free safety, and or frustrating Garland and double teams or trapping him at the top of the key or at the top of the arc as well. Like, you can't have that if you want to take this next step. So Okoro has to keep defenses honest, and I think it could be a bit of an ongoing thing even into the beginning of the regular season. But at least for now, Caris LeVert is probably penciled in as the starter. But Okoro is who I would prefer if I had to pick, just because of the overall defensive upside you have. And as you noted, Bickerstaff's a defense-first coach. Kind of keep with your what you're comfortable with as well.
That was the main reason I had Okoro penciled, and I'm like, as far as the defensive wings or guys that you could plug in at that fifth starter spot, I mean, Okoro just makes a lot of sense to, like you said, right, kind of cover up some of the deficiencies maybe with that starting backcourt, at least defensively. But he's got to get the three ball down to make that happen. Last thing here, Evan, and I know you touched on this a little bit earlier, right? The Cavs maybe go from like that top end play in tournament team, sixth seed, give or take, to maybe, you know, fighting for home court advantage, you know, in the playoffs this next season. I just wonder, you know, how does this Cavs team in your eyes kind of stack up with the rest of the Eastern Conference? And, you know, does this trade really drastically impact, I guess, the timeline and maybe so the expectations for the team going into this season?
I think, yes, it does. I said this on my show. If they do not make the playoffs this year, like, trading for Donovan Mitchell is ultimately going to be a disappointment for this Cavs team, because at least publicly, and in the fan base, it's going to create the expectation of playoffs or bust. I doubt the Cavs will publicly say, hey, it's playoffs or bust for us, and we're trying to gun for the Eastern Conference Finals or a championship, because you don't really want to put that onus on such a young and impressionable roster. Like, walk before you crawl. Like, last season was such a surprise, but let's see if you can build upon that success and not fall flat on your face next year. But to your point, I think fighting for home court advantage, at least in the first round, is semi-plausible for Cleveland. We had Martin Rickman from Dime on the show the other day, and he's just like, Miami is really aging out quite a bit. I mean, yes, they have Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo, but like, the Cavs could be scrapping with them for that 4 seed. It could be a 4 or 5 battle with them, but they've passed Toronto in terms of talent right now. They've passed Chicago in terms of talent right now. They're definitely ahead of Charlotte and New York as well. But when you look at teams like Milwaukee, like teams like Boston, or even Philadelphia, and even Brooklyn as well, because they're just such a volatile wild card in themselves, it's going to be a bloodbath, as my co-host put it, where it's going to be every game is actually going to mean a lot, especially these big marquee matchups for the Cavs. And I think that makes it fun and exciting and compelling. But if you're the Cavs, you have to now weigh the options. Do we want to be as healthy as possible when we reach the postseason? Or do you want to take more of the Mike Budenholzer approach and make every regular season game matter, where we're trying to fight to be the best team record-wise? And before Donovan Mitchell was here, right around when Ricky Rubio went down, the Cavs were one of the top teams record-wise in the Eastern Conference. So I think it's semi-plausible it could happen. It's just hard to really forecast how an 82-game season goes, especially when we're in the early beginnings of September right now. But yeah, I think home court advantage, at least in the first round, is very plausible. Second round, that's tough. And home court advantage at the Eastern Conference playoffs, I have to say something definitely happened to Milwaukee and Boston to make that happen.
Will the Cavaliers be fighting for a top four seed this next season? How will the new dynamic backcourt between Donovan Mitchell and Darius Garland look once they actually make it on to the floor with one another? You're going to have us covered for all of that and more over at Locked On Cavs. Evan, I appreciate you stopping by Locked On NBA with me.
Thanks for having me, brother.
Coming up, the Utah Jazz side of the Donovan Mitchell trade. What does this mean for the rebuilding timeline for the Utah Jazz? How should Jazz fans feel about the overall return for Rudy Gobert and Donovan Mitchell? We're going to get there in just one moment. And final segment here at Locked On NBA Monday. As always, thank you for making Locked On NBA your first listen each and every day. For your second listen, be sure to go check out the Locked On NBA Big Board podcast for all of your NBA draft needs. Joining us now is David Locke from Locked On Jazz, who you can, of course, follow on Twitter at DLock09. Now, David, in the midst of this offseason, this is going to be a very different Utah Jazz team that we see fielding, you know, the court this next year. Let me see if I can get this all out in one breath. The total return for now Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert. 7 future first-round picks, 3 future first-round pick swaps, Malik Beasley, Patrick Beverley, Leandro Balmero, Jared Vanderbilt, Walker Kessler, Colin Sexton, Lauri Markkanen, and Ochai Agbaji. Whew, that's a mouthful right there.
It's a lot of pieces for 2 of the top, probably 20 players in the NBA. There were only 2 of the top 20 players other than Kevin Durant that were available this season, or Kyrie Irving. I mean, I think that they obviously both turned out to not be available. So there were 2 major pieces that were going to move in this offseason, and they both came from the Jazz, and the Jazz have started a rebuild similar to what your Rockets have done and what the Thunder have done. And they have done it with lots of different pieces, and it's got some interesting length to it on the backside with the amount of 2027 and 2029 picks, with I think a real chance to have 2 more coming from the Los Angeles Lakers here, who at some point may decide that Bojan Bogdanović and Malik Beasley or Bojan Bogdanović and Mike Conley are enough to give up those 2 2027 and 2029 picks. If it involves Malik Beasley, it has to wait till early in this week before he's eligible to be traded again.
If that winds up happening, then I think we can maybe even safely say that the Utah Jazz have a better war chest of future assets than even Sam Presti and the OKC Thunder and the pile of first-round picks that he has been hoarding over the years. But, David, I want to start with, and there may be some interesting parallels here. You know, I cover the Rockets. You're covering the Jazz. There, as you already alluded to, there's some interesting parallels between how some of these teams have kind of started their rebuilding journey. For the Thunder, it feels like they've been in that rebuilding territory for a little bit longer. But let's start with, why was this the time to hit the reset button, right? No more Quinn Snyder. Now Donovan Mitchell and Rudy Gobert out, the 2 guys who have been staples of this Jazz team for a long time. Why was now the right time to hit the reset button for Utah?
If you look at championship teams, what they're able to do is that they have scars along the way, and then those scars either bring them together, mold them, they build the scar tissue, shall we say, and then they work through that. It was a question I asked all season long to any time a coach or someone came into town who had been part of a championship team. What I neglected to do was to talk to all the players who were on teams that had had those same scars that had them not bond together and build scar tissue. And really what happened with the Jazz is you stem it back to the loss against the Denver Nuggets in the bubble, the disastrous loss to the LA Clippers. They never overcame those 2 items. Maybe they weren't better than that, too. I think there might be a theory that Quinn Snyder's coaching had taken a group and had them a better regular season team than they were a playoff team. And that there's, you know, there's a chance that that group just was a first or second round team and nothing more, and didn't have another route. They certainly, when the offseason started, they had no draft picks, they had no money, they had no free agent ability, and they went around the trade market trying to make moves, and they couldn't do it. So they had either something to do something very similar than what they've done the last 4 years, or build around either Rudy Gobert or Donovan Mitchell. I'm not entirely clear that Donovan Mitchell was willing to be the Paul Pierce of Danny Ainge's rebuild and stick around for 4 or 5 years in Utah while that rebuild was going on. And so if you get that offer from Minnesota and trade Rudy Gobert, your next choice is this full-scale rebuild. And they've done it interestingly. Jackson, the one thing I think – there's two things I think are really interesting about where they are in this. One is they actually have the 14th and 22nd pick of last year's draft. So they actually started the rebuild already with the 14th and 22nd pick of the draft. They also have three bona fide rotation players that are 24 or younger, and Markin and Beasley and Sexton. I don't know how long they all stick around. They have three pieces of like developing players in Balmero, in Vanderbilt, and guys that maybe will turn out to be, we'll see. And then then obviously they have the plethora of picks. And what will be interesting to see is who else is tanking with them. San Antonio looks to be. Houston and Oklahoma City are on the way up. Utah is now a few years behind Houston and Oklahoma City and Detroit. So maybe they're going to be, along with San Antonio, the only teams doing it at that period of time.
Yeah, I think at least if you're looking at the Western Conference, it feels like there's very safely four teams that are going to be kind of comfortably in the bottom of the West, Utah and Houston being two of them, and then also San Antonio and OKC, whereas the other 11 teams in the West all want a cut of the playoff action, and three of them are going to be wholly disappointed in how the results of the play-in tournament ultimately shake out, you know, once we get towards that point in the season. But David, I want to ask you, just how much does Danny Ainge's track record with what he accomplished with Boston give you confidence in his ability to you know, eventually build another contender in Utah, and kind of that this is the right way to go about doing it?
Well, this is Ainge's show. Let's not. Ryan Smith is the owner. He bought the team a few years ago. Danny Ainge came in. Justin Zanuck's a general manager doing a lot of work, but this is Danny Ainge's show. And then when you look at his track record, he's one of one or one of two, right? Pat Riley and Danny Ainge are probably the only people who've built NBA finals teams with the same franchise in different kind of groupings, right? San Antonio holds this thing together with Duncan, but there was the Ray Allen NBA finals team, and there's the Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown finals team. Okay, that was the Kevin Garnett, but Ray Allen would have liked if I said that. There's the LeBron James championship team, and there's the Dwayne Wade, Shaquille O'Neal championship team in Miami. You can't find a lot of general managers that have built two different teams, entirely different teams, up to be into the NBA finals. Ainge is one of those guys who's done that.
How do you kind of maybe reset your expectations, or even define your expectations for the organization, for the team, heading into a season like this?
I think your goal, if I understand, and I haven't talked to maybe the people I need to, but I think just kind of intuitively, if you look at what the Jazz have done, they have three first round picks in 2029, Minnesota, Cleveland, their own. They have three picks in 2027. Minnesota, Cleveland, their own. They have a pick swap in 2028. And I think they have two pick swaps in 2026. If you look at what I think the Jazz do here, is they start this process. They've got a few pieces already we just talked about. And now, for the next 3 years or so, you're trying to acquire your top five talent, right? You're trying to get your Jalen Green, your Jabari Smith, your Chet Holmgren, your Josh Giddey, whatever that, your Cade Cunningham. Whatever those pieces are. So 2023 draft, 2024 draft, 2025 draft, maybe the 2026 draft. But by then you would hope you're starting onto the uptick. And now as you build up to 35, 40, 45, 50 wins, now all of a sudden you go get the Cleveland and Minnesota picks of 2027. You go get the Cleveland and Minnesota picks of 2029. And hopefully at that point you're a 45, 50 win team, and you hit on one of those pieces that bounces you now up into the top groups of the Western Conference. I think that's the route that you're trying to get, and that's why those picks, Cleveland had to push theirs back because of their some rules, but that's why. And the other thing the Jazz have done that's interesting is no differently than Utah, Cleveland and Minnesota are not free agent markets. If something goes wrong in Minnesota where Anthony Edwards wants out or Karl Anthony Towns doesn't like playing with Rudy Gobert, they're not going to be able to fill that with free agency. If Cleveland has something go awry, Donovan leaves when he's a free agent and maybe Mobley asks out or Garland wants out, they're not going to be able to rebuild that. Those are not free agent markets that are going to be able to rebuild if something goes wrong and the Jazz have their draft picks virtually unprotected. Minnesota's in 2029, 1 through 5 protected.
We won't get into a win season prediction or anything of that sort here in this segment, but I will say, David, that out of the last 30 years of Utah Jazz basketball, the Jazz have only had 2 sub-30 win seasons across the last 30 years. That's kind of absurd to think about. A very winning franchise when you look at it through that lens. And in those 2 subsequent 30 win seasons, one happened in 04-05, in which the Jazz subsequently had the number 3 overall pick, and they picked up none other than Deron Williams. Great player. Great time with the Utah Jazz. 13-14 was the other year that it happened. They drafted Dante Exum, number 5. And, you know, whether or not you go back and you look at, like, Dante Exum's potential, what have you, at least there's some optimism maybe here that the Jazz are probably going to be in good positioning, if history repeats itself, to walk away with at least a top pick in this upcoming year's draft, which, hey, the crown jewel of the draft is one Victor Wembanyama. So I will leave you with this, David, the final question. Just your early, your way too early preliminary prediction for if the Jazz were to walk away with the number 1 overall pick. Are you currently leaning Victor Wembanyama, or are you going to go with maybe the minority and say Scoot Henderson?
I actually know absolutely nothing, but I will become my second listen after listening to myself do Locked On Jazz for your team every day will become Locked On NBA Big Board this year, as it will be for many Jazz fans, Rockets fans, Thunder fans, and Spurs fans. Locked On NBA Big Board will be our second listen.
Some of the best insider draft knowledge, of course, located over at Locked On NBA Big Board. But we look forward to you becoming a Locked On NBA draft insider as well, David, as you kind of navigate this next season. And of course, you're going to have us covered for all of that over at Locked On Jazz. David, I appreciate you stopping by Locked On NBA with me.
Thanks, Jackson. Great work.
That's going to do it for another Monday edition of Locked On NBA. As always, thank you so much for checking out the show. If you haven't done so yet, please consider subscribing wherever you listen to your podcast. That's Apple, Spotify, Google, the Odyssey app, free and available on all podcast platforms. We're also on YouTube. Just go to YouTube, search Locked On NBA. Be sure to like, comment, and subscribe. But as always, thank you so much for listening. And we look forward to having you back right here at Locked On NBA, the biggest stories with the local experts.